The motor runs on the resistance space puts up to being changed. Soth was dangling the contract in his claws. What I have told you about cyclomath applies to all of it and can be used in solving anything but teleportation. Johnny brightened. At least it would apply to the hundreds of thousands of patents. Still, it meant no motors. It condemned him to eventually flying reaction engines. It meant Desperation Defense wouldn't have an easy conversion to peacetime. Then he recalled something. But executives used to repair motor consoles, he said. Soth sat up. He looked at the contract and then at Johnny. You just want the circuit itself? I thought you were interested in the mathematics. Mathematics is a pure subject, he added with the vehemence of any dedicated hobbyist. But if you want just the circuit... He was fishing around under books and papers. Where's my breathe gas mask? In minutes, they were outside and Johnny was issuing the orders Soth wanted relayed. A console was to be removed from a plane, one from a ground car, and one from a flying platform. And they were to be brought at once to the repair shop without being further tampered with. Mechanics went racing about. Presently, the three consoles were sitting on the floor of the repair shop. These are the three different types of consoles for motor drives. All other motor consoles are one or another of these types. Now, you will have to give me a hand. I am not as strong as I was once. Soth closed the door, barring everyone else. He reached up on a shelf and brought down a poison ore bag. Johnny had seen them often enough. They were transparent. They had two very tight armholes you could put your hands and arms into. He thought they were used when one sorted out arsenic compounds used in ore refining. Soth, with a little help from Johnny, struggled the ground car console into the bag. Then he stuffed in all the trailing connection wires that had just been severed from the vehicle. He sealed the bag tight. He connected an air hose to the fitting at the bottom, and the bag around the console began to inflate. He picked up a pressure gauge and a toolkit and shoved these through the armholes. Then he put his own arms in and snapped seals around his elbows. Through the transparent top, he watched the pressure gauge he had put in. 100 pounds is what you want, he said. The bag inflated. The gauge went up to 100. He checked his elbow seals. The pressure was holding. Soth picked up a screwdriver from the kit he had put inside and swiftly took out the screws of the top plate. Johnny looked on, fascinated. He had done that once with a tank console, and it had promptly ceased to work. But Soth simply took the screws out. He lifted the top of the console, which contained all the buttons, completely off, and bunched the cables which led to it. He then looked into the console itself. There were all kinds of components in there, but unlike a rig, it had no insulating board. Soth selected a wire with clips on both ends and fastened it on either side of three components to bypass them. Pressure fuses, said Soth. The whole inside of one of these consoles is carried at high pressure. If the pressure drops, any one of those three fuses expands and blows. If anyone monkeys with the cover, it lets the atmosphere out very silently. That blows these fuses. Except for the fuses and the erase surge components, everything else you're looking at there is garbage. Sensible seeming, but really just garbage. It has nothing to do with the console operation. I have jumped a wire across the fuses. They will blow, and I'll have to replace them. But the wipe mechanism won't work now. The real circuit is still intact. Johnny was wondering where the real circuit was, if that vast area of components was just garbage. But Soth knew what he was doing. He kicked the pressure hose with a foot, and the bag deflated. He withdrew his arms and pulled off the fasteners. The bag fell away. Soth turned the console over. These buttons would appear to go down like ordinary keys and hit the false circuit, but that isn't how it operates. The whole circuit is in the cover. When you push a button, it cuts off an internal light path and makes the circuit operate. Each button works like that. A totally hidden circuit done with molecular alignment in the cover plate. And if you fooled with it, it wiped the circuit out. One cover screw loosened and you had no console anymore. "Where's some paper?" said Soth. He found a big sheet of it, larger than the console plate. "Where's some powdered iron?" He found some, the dust-like brown-black powder, almost capable of floating in the air, so fine was it. Soth dusted the powder on the white paper and spread a thin coat of it. Then, struggling to keep the bunched cables from tangling, he laid the console cover right side up on the paper. He took some jump wires, found a battery, and linked the battery to the console amid a flash of sparks. He was fixing it so that the cover and buttons would have juice running through it. Soth exactly positioned the cover on the paper and then rapidly tapped each console button. Johnny suddenly understood what he was doing. He held up a hand to prevent Soth from removing the cover. Johnny got a metal analysis camera off a shelf, stood up on a stool, and shot a picture straight down. When Johnny had finished, Soth gently lifted up the cover. There on the paper, drawn in magnetically grouped iron filings, was the whole circuit. Activated by pushing the buttons, each part of it had grouped the iron filings. On the removal, a tiny part of it had gotten blurred, but Johnny had it in the camera. To be sure, he now took another picture of the tiny, thin, brown-black lines. They had that circuit. Soth put it all back in the bag, inflated it to 100 pounds, replaced the blown fuses, checked the plate gasket, and then screwed the console back together. 2 hours later, they had all three types of motor console circuits. They put everything away, called the mechanics, and had the consoles put back in the vehicles and connected. Johnny made a test. They all started the motors. Very different from a firing rig. Very different indeed. 7. Back in his room, old Soth was tired and coughing a bit from having overexerted himself this day. Johnny sat on an improvised bench and waited for him to get his breath. Eventually, Soth said, "I can't dismantle or put together a teleportation shipping rig. Only Turl could do that. And I surely can't build one, either. So maybe I shouldn't take this contract." He held it up between a couple of claws, looked at it longingly, and then handed it to Johnny. Johnny couldn't help but wonder how this race might have been if it hadn't been for the Catrists messing up their brains. "No, no," said Johnny, pushing it back at him. "You've done fine. In fact, the key you have given me to routine cyclomathematics has probably unlocked the door to a parade of inventions Intergalactic was sitting on. You may have helped bring prosperity to many, many worlds."
"Really?" said Soth. He thought it over. "That's nice. Yes, that's very nice."
He was pondering something.
"You know," Soth said after a while, "you have something of a security problem, too. An awful lot of people, of an awful lot of races, would do anything to get their hands on cyclomathematics and some developments they stole. You know, don't you, that Professor N, who developed teleportation, was a box nerd? No? Well, he was. Yes, people will be trying to get this data, but I think I can help."
He thought for quite a while.
"Yes, I think I can do it."
He smiled.
"Like any hobbyist, I like to fiddle around. And about 50 years ago, I was on a dreadful planet, not even a tree. I set myself the problem of putting cyclo-higher math into a computer. The company and the government would have had fits had it been reported, but I remember the circuits I devised. It would work all right, but I'd need some facilities and components."
A computer? Johnny had been dreading solving hundreds of thousands of formulas to get whatever inventions they'd found into use. If he had a computer, anyone on his staff could rattle them off. "If you do that," said Johnny,
I'll give you 1,000,000 credits out of my own pocket.
1,000,000 credits? Gawped Soth. There isn't that much money.
He was fumbling around through his litter of paper. Johnny thought he was trying to find some reference, but then saw he was trying to locate a Kerbango saucepan. Soth obviously felt he needed a stimulant. The saucepan was empty, and Johnny got a package of Kerbango from his pocket and put it in the pan. Soth chewed a small bit of it, thankfully, remembered his manners, and offered Johnny some, which was, of course, declined.
You startled me, said Soth, but that wasn't all I was going to tell you.
He chewed for a bit, got his heart beating again to his satisfaction.
I have been fooling about converting simpler cycloarithmetic to the decimal system.
He went into the litter of papers again, found what he wanted on the floor, and showed it to Johnny.
It's quite an amazing system. Children and people learn it quite easily. The Cyclo Empire actually held on to the 11 system just so others could get more mixed up.
They mixed me up, said Johnny.
Well, I should think they did, but that was all part of the security program. Anyway, all the basic arithmetic functions and the lesser formulas can be converted over to the decimal system. Then maybe they'll even put money into the decimal system, as I see the Galactic Bank's new issue remains in the 11 system. Now, here is the good part. The decimal system will go into general use. Nobody will want anything to do with the clumsy 11 system, and it will go into disuse.
He sat back triumphantly.
You'll have your computer. The 11 system will phase out. People will consider it some old curiosity and forget it. And that in itself is a kind of security precaution.
Johnny had found a piece of paper and was writing on it rapidly.
A second contract? Said Soth, reading it upside down.
In addition to the first contract, said Johnny, 2,000,000 credits if you make the computer, and 1,000,000 if you convert basic cyclo math to the decimal system.
Oh dear, said Soth. I could collect a warehouse full of mathematics texts with that. 10 warehouses. 50. Quick, don't change your mind. Let me sign it.
When they had finalized it, Soth looked at it for a while.
You know, on Cyclo, that would make me very rich. One would have 12 females, raise a huge family, become almost a noble dynasty. But it's all finished.
There are still some Cyclos here, said Johnny. There are several females. The race isn't finished.
Ah, said Soth. You don't know.
He sagged.
The Catrists long ago pulled back the only Cyclo colonies that had begun. They convinced the throne that colonies on other planets might mutate, be able to live in other atmospheres, and constitute a threat to the crown. So they insisted that all babies born be born only on Cyclo.
Where they could put capsules in their heads, thought Johnny.
Occasionally, very rarely, continued Soth, a royal noble could take his own females to other planets, but only with a whole Catrist team along. All female employees of the company, by long-standing order from the Catrists, had to be permanently sterilized before being shipped away from the home planet.
You mean... Johnny gestured to the rest of the compound area.
Yes, said Soth. All these females are sterilized. They cannot have any pups.
He sat for a while, pensive.
You might think I hold it against you for destroying that planet. I don't, you know. From the moment the Catrists began to gain power, the race started to go bad. The way I look at it, he continued, their program of degrading everyone, suppressing any group who sought a new morality, calling everybody animals, turned Cyclo into a beast. People all over the universes, all through the ages, prayed for the end of that empire. It was hated.
He looked at Johnny.
Sooner or later, someone was bound to rid the galaxies of Cyclo. Whole races have dreamed that dream. You,
and he pointed a talon at Johnny.
"They think you did it. You didn't. That whole civilization was doomed the moment the Catrists began to influence it. It wasn't you. It was they who destroyed Cyclo and the whole empire. Turl was their product, and I believe he had a hand in their destruction in some way. You know, I've heard he used to sit around in the recreation hall and tell people that man was an endangered species. Because of the Catrists, the Cyclos have been an endangered species for millennia, and now they're not just endangered, they're extinct."
He sighed and looked at his litter of papers.
"Well, maybe I can help make up for some of the crimes they have done."
Then he looked at Johnny.
"As for you, Johnny, good boy Tyler, have no qualms about it. When you destroyed Cyclo, you gave all the galaxies a chance to return to better ways. I didn't need these contracts. You have offered them, and I will keep them. But it is a privilege to help you, and I thank you for the chance."
Epilogue. A few months later, Johnny heard that the government in Scotland was going to introduce taxation in order to rebuild Edinburgh. He knew that taxation had been unknown in the earliest days of the Scottish nation. The king had just paid for everything way back then. And he doubted Scotland had the resources to do it. Also, he felt a taxation, as a government way of life, was a sort of silly business. Couldn't a government earn its keep? Why did it have to go around robbing people? So he talked to Donald Dean and got him to sell the idea to the chief of Clan Fergus that Edinburgh would be rebuilt by contributions. To foster the illusion that the Scottish people were paying for it, he and Donald Dean put little red boxes along trails where Scots could drop in small coins, and they even emptied some of them. But what really happened was that Johnny paid for it. He sent in his Chataverian construction company, Buildstrong Incorporated. They had finished all the industrial requirements at Luxembourg and banking requirements at Zurich anyway. The Chataverians, being Chataverians, sent a research team all around Scotland and the government to find out what people wanted at Edinburgh, and then went on and did what they thought was right regardless. They decided Edinburgh would be in three businesses: planetary government, extraterrestrial training, and Scottish handicraft. It was a real headache to them to reconcile such divergent actions into architecture, which they always maintained must be A, indigenous, and B, suitable for the purpose. The city itself, their research team found, had once been nicknamed Auldreekie because it smelled so bad. They also found no Scot had lived in it for 1,100 years. This gave them a totally free hand. They rammed down everything except Castle Rock. They got several Highland hydroelectric plants back in operation rapidly, and then called in their companion company, Desperation Defense, and had them make their installations and emplacements. They then put in sewer systems and filtration plants, and then they rubbed their hands and really got to work. They put the northern section of the town into industrial, for business and handicrafts, and gave it the overall look and landscaping of stone cottages, such as the Scots were used to in the Highlands. They sweepingly planned out a large number of specialty schools. Outside, they were all Scotch baronial with the little projecting turrets, castles right out of the old fairy tale books. But the whole of the interiors were adapted to extraterrestrial living. They spread these all over the terrain with big parks. Castle Rock itself they saved for government. It had been so battered and fractured they had to get early engravings of it to see how to shape it. Shaping and armoring rock was no problem to the Chataverians, but what it had been like a couple thousand years ago was. They got an indication that a castle of an early Scottish king, Duncan, who apparently had been killed by Macbeth, had stood there. Where they got this was a mystery. Somebody said an old play they had found in the wreckage of the British Museum. They reassembled the rock, rebuilt its interior shelters, covered the whole thing with blue Italian marble, got it all armor-hard and glowing, and then put Duncan's castle on it in gleaming white. They found a cathedral they liked in an ancient city called Reims, that they said agreed with the architecture of the castle, and put it up on the rock in shimmering scarlet and called it St. Giles again. The Scots were enraptured with the result of what they had financed. Johnny thought it looked pretty good, too. But it did produce a problem. The Chatoverians, being overpopulated at home, always overhired, and as this job had been rush, and for the boss himself, they had accumulated a very huge crew. They also had a policy that you never fired anybody ever. It left him with a swollen city-building team almost the size of Earth's entire population. So he put them to work rebuilding the cities the visitors had burned. This, too, gave the Chatoverians a problem. What were the cities for? Nobody had lived in a city for 1,100 years. So their research teams had to figure out what future use the cities might be put to, based on resources, proximity to rivers and the sea, what crops grew in that climate, who they might someday trade with, how many people would have to be housed for what industry. It was very complex and quite difficult. Establishing the indigenous architecture was easy in Asia, fairly easy in Europe, impossible in America. This last continent had gone madly modern, and the Chatoverians couldn't abide it. So they just had to take the most interesting landmark sort of buildings they found on the sites, duplicate those, and make lots and lots of parks. The parent company in Chatoveria had overbought Zip monorails on another job, so they shipped those in and internally connected the cities up high so their parks wouldn't be spoiled with roads. They had to get a Hauven company in to clean up the radiation around Denver. They did it with flying magnetic sweeps. Then the Chatoverians rebuilt that whole area, including even Johnny's village. There were no populations, so when they would finish a city, they would just seal up the doors and windows, put a caretaker crew in, and leave it. Oh well, Johnny thought, when he saw all these empty cities going up, maybe somebody would live in them someday. Kerr took charge of the mine school in Edinburgh, and the cyclos that were left alive moved there and gave lectures and demonstrations. Absolute hordes of extraterrestrials were pouring in to learn how to mine their own planets and get the metals moving again. Kerr pictographed all the lectures so the technology wouldn't be lost. He used Cornwall and Victoria for practical training, and it kept him pretty busy, tearing around with Chirk, who had the job of building up the libraries. Kerr had a trick of wearing breathe masks with the face of the race he was training painted on it. It made for friendlier relations, he said. There were an awful lot of ex-cyclo planets that had slave populations or people withdrawn to mountains, and the coordinators were very busy running their coordinator college in Edinburgh, showing former subject races how to get organized and prosper. Their enrollment was greatly assisted by the fact that the Galactic Bank gave much more favorable interest rates to such planets when they had coordinators trained in Edinburgh. The New Earth government claimed that Chief of Clan Fergus was king, probably due to the influence of Mr. Tsung's brother. This made Dunnel Dean the crown prince, but from all Johnny could see, neither the chief nor Dunnel Dean took his elevation very seriously. The government was very reluctant to pass laws and generally left things up to tribal chiefs in their own areas, intervening only when there was no other way to end a dispute among them. They were very popular. Colonel Ivan, with the title of the Democratic Valiant Red Army People's Colonel, ruled Russia. Johnny's village people helped him, and then some of the younger ones went back to America to try to get it started again. Chief Chong Wan and the North Chinese tribe made an alliance and began to build up China. Handicraft and silk for export handled their economic needs. They also had a cooking school that became widely attended, for the Salachis spread all over the galaxies, even farther due to their neighborhood banks, swore it was the best cooking anywhere, particularly for fish dishes, and were quick to finance any extraterrestrial who wanted to start a Chinese restaurant in his area, providing he sent some cook trainees to learn how. There were usually more cook trainees in China than Chinese. They not only had to learn to cook, but also had to learn how to grow much of the food. The extra labor and machinery boomed Chinese agriculture and fisheries, and as Chief Chang Wan remarked every time he saw Johnny, which was often, starvation was no longer the main product of the Chinese. Johnny often wondered how an extraterrestrial, who ate quite another diet, could learn to cook food he would never eat. But the power of the bank and the appetites of the Salachis were similarly wonderful. Pursuant to wide galactic conversion to the decimal system, the bank distributed new issues of money. These upset Chrissy considerably. The coins and banknotes looked even less like Johnny. She went on for some days about how they looked even more like a Salachi and even less like Johnny, but Johnny didn't tell her he had carefully maneuvered things in that direction. These days he could walk right down a street and hardly anybody pointed. A couple more issues and no stranger would know him on sight at all. The bank in Snouch never did return their gold. When they built the huge new bank complex there, they put the gold behind armor glass in the main lobby with a multi-language sign on it. This gold was mined personally by Johnny Goodboy Tyler and some Scots. He has left it with us because he trusts us. So can you. If you start your new account today, you can reach through a slot and touch it. When Johnny wanted some gold to plate the inaugural display model of a new teleport car Desperation Defense was now converting to build in Chataveria, Dwight had to go to the Andes with a team of the old crew and open up a mine there to get it. After the surveys on what people wanted were done by the bank, as Johnny suggested, the conversion of X-Arms companies to consumer products went very swiftly. Few of the intergalactic patents were in any demand for a while. They found the people on civilized planets wanted pots and pans and such like, all of which were easily made and quite profitable. The original emissaries were now becoming very wealthy and powerful and backed Johnny's measures to the limit, even guiding their countries toward social democracy. Johnny seldom attended their conferences, but they often rushed dispatch boxes to him to get his opinion on something. As they often told each other, anti-war was the most profitable venture they had ever heard of. The Hauven Commercial Intelligence Service circulated a secret report on the 28 platforms without knowing it had been planted on them by the Galactic Bank. They had been chosen for the leak because they were the most infiltrated intelligence service in any universe. The report was rapidly and secretly relayed all over the galaxies. It alleged that the original 28 had been increased to 53 to allow for new nations, and that the platforms were actually located in the 17th universe. The report created a new flurry of anti-war. But it also created astrographic turmoil, as it upset the stable datum that, as the number 4, when squared, made 16, there could only be 16 universes. Immediate action resulted. Several scientific bodies began searching, not necessarily to find the firing platforms, but to see whether there was a 17th universe. The Democratic Royal Institute of Chataveria did find an additional universe, but since it was just forming and had no evidence of sentient life in it, and since there was no trace of anything to put platforms on, it concluded it must be the 18th universe. The 17th universe containing the platforms remains undiscovered to this day. And, as Johnny sometimes told himself, this was not hard to understand. It was in his head. He never built the platforms. McAdam had told Johnny that quite a few of the old Intergalactic Mining Company reserve planets, even though habitable and currently uninhabited, were a drag on the market. So Johnny, by special Salachi couriers from his own staff, secretly informed the original emissaries of different groups of planets on the list. They promptly made deals with the company and then rushed the planets into the real estate market with the slogan, "Enjoy peaceful, untargeted suburban living." And they made even vaster fortunes for themselves and their friends.
They swore by Johnny. Peace was one of the most profitable discoveries ever made. During that period, the only sour bit of news that came Johnny's way was brought to him by his accounts staff. It had increased to 200 Salachis to keep track of his income. They told him that the Earth Division of Build Strong Incorporated was now the only company he had that was running in the red. All the rest were way up in the black. Johnny said he'd have a word with its general manager, and he did. He found that they had added to their payroll another 200,000 Chataverian workers. The general manager explained they were not just building the burned Earth cities now, but had branched out and were rebuilding all the others, and had a 200-year construction program they had all planned out and didn't want interrupted. Johnny told him and his six assistant general managers that he was building cities for which no populations existed nor would exist in the next several centuries, and that they better start figuring out how to show a profit. They said they would, but in return he insisted they keep on with their program. No, they didn't have any plans to settle Earth with Chataverians. They knew that would engulf man. It was just that when they got going doing something, they built up an awfully big momentum. Johnny thought it didn't much matter anyway, so he forgot about it. Sometime after that, Stormalong got bored with demonstrating the new teleportation-motored atmosphere transports Desperation Defense was selling all over the galaxies and training pilots for, and he talked Johnny into letting him rehabilitate an old company orbit miner with cranes and fly to the moon. Johnny talked Stormalong into first getting some pressure suits and then getting three other pilots as crazy as Stormalong, refitting four orbit miners and doing it right. Stormalong had the excuse that he wanted to go see whether he could find some more of that heavy metal. He figured that flights of meteorites had now hit the moon. It took them 2 months to get ready and to make the trip and return. They found the meteorites with heavy metal traces all right, and mined them, and brought back about 200 tons of ore to process. But Stormalong brought back startling news.
"There's footprints up there," he told Johnny, "and tire treads."
This being in the world of tracking, Johnny was very interested. They speculated on the possibility they had invaders, but the Desperation Defense people pooh-poohed it. Nothing could get through their defenses. They then wondered if it might not have been the visitors putting down there during the war. Johnny wasn't going to spend weeks in space in an orbit miner, so he chartered Dries Glotten's space yacht for a weekend, and he and Stormalong were taken up to have another look. Yes, sir. Footprints. Tire treads. Then the sharp-trained eye of Johnny spotted a paper wrapper that must have been discarded and lay almost covered with dust. It said, "Carefree Sugarless Gum, Spearmint, 15 Sticks, Lifesavers Incorporated, New York City." Stormalong thought it must be some salvage gear from a wreck, maybe. But there was no wreck. Dries thought that maybe it was used to repair holes. Gum, you know. Johnny wouldn't let them mess up the tracks with their own. He picto-recorded them, and then backtracked them and found a cairn with the very faded remains of what might have been a flag. Then, although he had trouble walking with almost no weight, he hiked around and found another cairn with another flag in it, also faded beyond recognition. That was all they found. But Johnny showed them that the exposed edge of the wrapper was much more faded than the buried part, and from that he deducted that these tracks and cairns were hundreds of years old. So they decided it was not an immediate danger and started back home. The real discovery was made on the way back. Johnny was admiring Dries's communication gear, and Dries showed him the first pictures he had taken of the planet, and Johnny noticed there seemed to be much more cloud cover now. He did more comparisons. They were flashing down toward Europe, of course, but they could still see northern Africa and the Middle East. The latter was green, and the former had a new sea in the middle of it. Landed again, even though he was late for Sunday night supper, Johnny got right on to the Desperation Defense duty officer and wanted to know if he was aware of planetary changes. He was, and referred Johnny to the general manager of Build Strong. You ordered us to show a profit, the general manager said defensively. So we hired some more Chatoverians and started a health subsidiary. We figured Build Strong could also be interpreted to mean strong bodies. Johnny wanted to know what the devil he had done now. And it seemed there was a below-sea-level spot in the dry wasteland of the Sahara Desert, so they let the Mediterranean in and made a new sea that would furnish rainfall. And they had machine-gun planted 85 quadrillion trees there, and also in the Middle East, where they wouldn't require much water. Good varieties, slow-growing, but very tasty. And they'd planted another 16 quadrillion in the Middle West of the American continent. Oh, Johnny hadn't seen that part of the continent? Well, there used to be trees on that huge central flat plain. They could prove it by fossil remains. Anyway, he was sorry if it had changed the climate, but it usually did, you know. Cleaned up the air, too. Johnny wanted to know how spending that much money and hiring that new army of Chatoverians was going to make a profit. And the general manager showed him the balance sheets now. They were all in the black. They were exporting food trees to food-short Chatoverian planets. Johnny forgave him, raised his pay, and went home to a very late Sunday dinner. Another incident worthy of note happened about that time. Johnny, wearing an extraterrestrial atmosphere mask to keep from being stopped on the street and gathering crowds, attended a fair in Zurich, and there he saw Pierre Solon. The ex-pilot was in beggar's rags and holding forth to an audience about how he personally, with his own eyes, had seen Johnny Goodboy Tyler walk on a cloud and, not only that, pull a demon out of it and sing a duet with him. When he had finished his story, he passed around a battered cup for offerings. It seemed he made his living this way. When he got to Johnny, Johnny pulled his mask down and Pierre nearly fainted again. There were so many exaggerations and lies going around about Johnny that he figured he didn't need another one. So he forced Pierre into a plane, took him right down to Africa, and made him get into another plane at Victoria and by himself fly it up to the peak where the cyclocadavers still lay in the snow, land, look, fly back down through the overcast, and land. Pierre made it without wrecking himself, and Johnny took him back to Luxembourg. Pierre said, "Thank you," and he meant it. He went back to his old job of moving the compound planes around the hangar, and in time became an acceptable pilot. There was a bizarre incident that occurred in Edinburgh. The sarcophagus of Biddy MacLeod had been miraculously preserved in the bombings. Three beams of the collapsing cathedral had fallen across it almost protectively. The Chatoverians had repositioned it in the new cathedral crypt in a row of dead war heroes, which included Glen Cannon's recovered remains. When she was 16, Patty demanded that she be taken to the crypt and married to Biddy MacLeod. Nothing could dissuade her, and she stood there beside the sarcophagus in a white wedding dress, holding Biddy's locket with "To My Future Wife" on it. The parson, who could find no law against it, went through the wedding ceremony. She then changed to widow's weeds, and after that called herself Mrs. Patty MacLeod. Still continuing with her medical training, she founded the MacLeod Intergalactic Health Organization. Johnny funded it, and it became a standard stop point on and off all firing platforms throughout the galaxies. It also provided instant medical service. Two other events had occurred. Johnny and Chrissy had a boy born to them, Timmy Brave Tyler, an absolute carbon copy of Johnny, as everybody swore. And 2 years later, they had a girl, Missy, that everyone affirmed was a mirror image of Chrissy. When Timmy was 6, Johnny blew up. Their boy was not getting properly educated. He had uncles by the absolute score. Uncle Colonel Ivan, Uncle Sir Robert, Uncle Dunnell Dean. And every Scot who had mined or served with Johnny was an uncle. They spoiled the child rotten. They brought him things from all over the world. But were they seeing to it that Timmy was properly educated? No. He did speak several languages after a fashion. Russian, Chinese, Chatoverian, Cyclo, and English. He could do sums in his head when it suited him, and he could drive a teleportation go-cart Angus and Tom Smiley had made for him. But Johnny was faced with the specter of a son who would grow up totally ignorant of the vital things in life. Johnny had made up his mind. Affairs were running fine, handled mostly by others anyway. So he took a few bare necessities, bundled Timmy and Chrissy and Missy and four horses into an old Marine attack plane, and flew to southern Colorado. He disconnected the plane's phone and radio, and hid the ship in a clump of trees, and made camp. For the whole of the next year, rain or shine, Johnny worked on Timmy. Missy was fine, and she helped her mother very well, and learned all about real tanning and cooking and things like that. But it was Timmy who got the attention. At first, Johnny had it a little rough, for the boy obviously was getting a delayed start. But after a few months, he saw he was making real progress. The boy learned to track, to spot different animals and their immediate intentions. He learned to round up wild horses and train them, and he didn't need a sissy thing like a saddle. He came right along, and was quite cheerful about it. Johnny got him to throw kill clubs with considerable accuracy, and he even nailed a coyote with one. Johnny was just beginning to feel some security about the boy's future, and was about to post-graduate him into stalking wolves and then pumas. But on the very first day of this, he heard a plane in the afternoon sky. It wasn't a drone, it was a plane, heading for the plume of smoke that marked their current camp. Johnny and the boy trotted back, Johnny with uneasy forebodings. It was Dunnell Dean and Sir Robert. Timmy sprang at them like a small windstorm, shrieking glad shrieks of welcome.
"Uncle Dunnell Dean! Uncle Wobbert!"
Johnny's manners let Chrissy fix them some supper. They didn't seem to be in any hurry to get on with their business. Evening came, and the two of them and the family sat around the bonfire singing Scottish songs. Then Timmy showed them he hadn't forgotten the Highland Fling, and danced it for them like Thor had taught him. Finally, when the children and Chrissy had gone to bed, Dunnell Dean made the wholly unnecessary statement,
"I suppose you're wondering why we're here."
"What's the bad news?" said Johnny.
"It isn't any bad news," grumped Sir Robert. "We've been holding 16 universes together like glue. Why should there be any bad news?"
"It's been a year," said Dunnell Dean.
"You came for something," said Johnny suspiciously.
"Well," said Dunnell Dean, "as a matter of fact, come to think of it, we did. A couple of years ago, you made a tour of all the Earth tribes. It's been proposed that you make a tour of the major civilizations of the galaxies. A lot of governments want to bestow honors and estates and medals and things on you because galactic conditions are so prosperous."
It made Johnny very cross. "I told you I was taking a year off. Don't you realize I have family responsibilities? What kind of father would I be to let my son grow up like an educated savage?" He really let them have it. Dunnell Dean heard him out and then laughed.
"We thought you'd say that, so we sent Thor instead."
Johnny studied that over. Then he said, "So, if you handled it, why have you come?" Sir Robert looked at him.
"Your year is up, laddie. Doesn't it ever occur to you that your friends miss you?"
So Johnny went back home, and while Timmy learned to speak 15 languages and do 5 kinds of math, while he learned to drive a ground car like Care and drive and fly anything the company made on any planet, including Dries Glotten's new yacht, his education was never finished. It was probably the one failure in Johnny Goodboy Tyler's life. Dr. McDermott, the historian who considered himself expendable, lived on and on. He wrote a book, The Johnny Goodboy Tyler I Knew, or The Conqueror of Cyclo, Pride of the Scottish Nation. It was not as good as this book, for it was intended for semi-literate people. But it had 3-dimensional pictures that moved in full color. He had access to several archives, and it sold 250 billion copies in its first printing. It was translated into 98,000 different galactic languages and went into many editions. Dr. McDermott received royalties so far in excess of anything his simple life needed that he endowed the Tyler Museum. It is the first building you see, the one with the golden dome, when you leave the McLeod Intergalactic Health Organization exit at the Denver terminal. Not too long after his return from America, Johnny disappeared. His family and friends were very concerned. But they knew that he disliked adulation and being unable to move about without attracting crowds. He had remarked that he was not needed now, and that he had done his work. A pouch, two kill clubs, and a knife were also missing. The dragon helmet and bright buttoned tunic were still there on a peg where he had last hung them. But people in the galaxies do not know that he is gone. If you ask almost anyone on a civilized planet where he is, you are likely to be told that he is there, just over that hill, waiting in case the Lords or the Cyclos come back. Try it. You'll see. They will even point. This concludes the reading of Battlefield Earth, Part 2, by L. Ron Hubbard. This book was read by Michael Rosato.